Welcome to Money Talks from Sleep Money. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, and I am here with Gary Stevenson. Gary, welcome. Introduce yourself. Who are you?
My name's Gary Stevenson. I'm a former trader from London. In 2011, I was Citibank's most profitable trader in the world. I made that money by betting that the global economy would basically collapse forever. And I've just written a book explaining how I did that.
And what is the name of the book?
The book is called The Trading Game. Trading Game, which refers to a couple of things, but most explicitly the card game which I won when I was at university, which is how I won my job as a trader back in 2006.
It's a very similar to poker card game. They basically get a whole bunch of would-be traders in a room and play something which is not dissimilar to Texas Hold'em, where you have like your own card and then there are like face down cards, which are slowly turned up. And as you explain it amazingly very well in your book, like there's a huge amount of basically the same thing you have in poker, which is playing your opponents rather than your cards and doing sort of some basic psychology there. Are the skills needed to win that game similar to the skills needed to be a successful trader?
I think in some ways. So the thing which made me successful in that game is I knew exactly how economists would play that game, which is because there's an element of maths in the game, the economists would like obsess on doing the maths, working out what they should be betting. And they wouldn't be thinking at all about, you know, how do we actually win the game? What's the bigger picture? And I think that this is, in a sense, the same way which I became successful as a trader, in that I was trading 2008 or 2014, and I was betting on interest rates in that period. And that is a super interesting period, because for that entire period, all the markets, all the traders, all the economists said that interest rates, which were stuck at zero the whole time, would come back up to 2-3% next year. We actually had 10 years of economists and traders saying that. And in a sense, I use the same skill, which is understanding the ways in which economists think and the ways in which economists are always wrong. And I think that the line which I use in the book is, the best trading you do it with your nose, it smells like stupidity. And I think that that is when you make money in markets, when everybody's wrong, which means that it's a great time to be a trader because everybody's been wrong for about 15 years now.
So I have so many different areas I want to like chase that thing down. The basic idea is that you made lots of money when you made lots of money by being right when everyone else was wrong. And that does seem to be one of the through lines of the book. That's how you win the trading game, or like technically, actually, it's how you lose the trading game. There's a sort of Kobayashi Maru situation at the beginning of the book where they like stack the deck against you and you're bound to die, and you stick to your guns on that one. And then as you're trading, you stick to your guns and you're like, I'm right and everyone is wrong. And so long as you're incredibly tenacious, and this also happens when you're trying to leave the bank, you stick to your guns and you're incredibly tenacious and you refuse to give up and you're like a dog with a bone. And this seems to be a part of your character, and it does seem to explain a lot of why you were as successful as you were. And I guess my question is that broadly extrapolatable to traders as a sort of group, or is that just you?
Traders tend to be more like that than perhaps other economists.
Do you consider traders to be like a subset of economists? Because that's the first thing that surprises me.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I mean, there is a big difference between academic economists and traders, but the vast majority of traders have got economics degrees, or if not, they've received an economics education. People who are trading, you know, economics related things like what I was doing, they've learned your classic ideas about economics, which are pretty much, you know, they're a monolith at the moment. Everybody believes the same thing. Everybody is taught the same thing. So I think the reason which I am so willing to sort of stand out and say everybody is wrong is I've seen it so much. So, you know, I come from very poor background in East London. And, you know, we speak about in the book how I sort of ended up at the London School of Economics, which is a very fancy university here in London. And I assumed when I got to the London School of Economics, the LSE, it would be full of geniuses because it's, you know, supposed to be one of the best universities in the world. But it definitely wasn't. You know, a lot of the people there had absolutely no idea what they were doing. They were just there because, you know, their dad was dictator of a small African country or whatever, you know, which is the way that LSE works nowadays. then when I got into Citibank, onto the trading floor, you know, these guys are getting paid millions of pounds a year. I thought it would be full of geniuses. I got there, you know, you've read the book. I was surrounded by basically nutcases. The guys I worked with were totally insane. And it was really obvious that they weren't that smart. And then, you know, 2008, which is when I started as a trader, economy collapses. Nobody had predicted it. 2009, 2010, 2011, super dead economy. Everybody had predicted a massive recovery. So I think when I was a kid, I believed that there were smart guys in the top jobs. And I was just, reality kept punching me in the face on that one. It became super obvious that, you know, the truth is most economists, most traders nowadays are kind of posh idiots.
So it didn't used to be like that, right? I mean, I've grown up with this idea of a trader is someone who's just kind of in the flows, who can read the tape, who it kind of doesn't matter what they're trading. You are trading interest rates, but you could be trading FX or stocks or fixed income or anything. And there's just like a deep trading skill that is divorced from the whole question of whether or not you understand the fundamentals. And you're saying, nah, it's actually down to like the reason you're successful is because you had a grasp of the fundamentals that other people lacked.
I think there's a couple of ways that a person can be a successful trader. Most traders who work, you know, for big banks like Citibank or other massive banks, they are what you might call market traders. They know the flows, they know the ins and the outs, they know the customers, they know the big players, they know what they're doing, they're following it around. They're kind of sort of, they know who they can rip off and when, they know when to push the market this way. This is sort of your small picture day-to-day trading. And most traders focus on that basically. And, you know, I did a bit of that when I first started, but, you know, I studied maths and economics when I was at university and I've studied it again since. What became clear to me when I was working as a trader, and this, you know, this discussed a lot in the book, is that the big picture analysis of the economy was just totally wrong. You know, in 2008, there was this massive crash nobody predicted. In 2008, everybody was saying massive bounce back recovery 2009. Didn't happen. 2009, everybody said 2010, massive bounce back recovery. Didn't happen. 2010, they said 2011. 2011, they said 2012. 2012, this is 2013. That happened every year until 2020, which is finally when markets agreed interest rates will never go back up. And the interest rates went to 6% the next year, basically. So, you know, you don't have to have a massive, excellent hand on the big picture economy to trade markets. You know, you can be this kind of wheeler dealer who understands your specific market that you're in. But we live in a period, in my opinion, where the economists have been really consistently, really horrendously wrong on the big picture economic calls ever since, you know, 2005, 2006, massively. So
there's this wonderful tale in the book about when you kind of like appoint yourself the Swiss franc dealer and you decide that you want to make a £100,000 bonus that year. And so the first thing you do is you put on a 1 year interest rate swap in Swiss francs, which should make you the 10 million quid or so that you need to make that bonus. And more broadly, the story, as you say, is like you were taking these big bets on interest rates not going up over a period of years. This is all at the same time as the Volcker rule is coming in. And you talk a lot in the book about how Citibank is encouraging the trading floor to take these kind of bets. But like, I remember that period as a financial journalist. And the one thing that everyone was saying was like, yeah, we really want to make sure that banks don't do that kind of thing. That is the kind of risk-taking activity that is not socially useful. We want to get that outside of the regulated banks and push that into, you know, hedge funds or wherever, where, you know, places that are small enough to fail. How old were you when you put on that, you know, 1 billion Swiss franc bet?
That Swiss franc trade would have been 2009. Yeah, so I would have been 22, very young.
You did $1 billion bet at the age of 22. Like if anyone in, you know, Citibank's regulator knew that this was happening, they would have been shocked, no?
I mean, it's been disgusting. Everybody was doing it at the time, you know, it's discussed in the book. And there's a sort of, so in 2009, I made $12 million for Citibank. I didn't make $12 million myself. And that was, I believe, the most profit anyone in that division of Citibank has ever made as a first year trader for, you know, as a 22, 23 year old, it probably is the highest profit anyone at that age has ever made. And there's a little passage in the book where I talk about why was that allowed? Why was I able to do that? And, you know, I would like to say it was because I was very canny and I sort of, you know, knew the ins and outs and played the politics. But the truth is, at that time, everybody was doing it. So I was in this area of trading, which is known as STIRT, short-term interest rate trading. Which trades FX swaps, foreign exchange swaps, which is a really unfashionable area of trading, like in the early 2000s, which is in that period, everybody wanted to be a credit trader. Then suddenly when 2008 happened, credit blew up. What we were doing is basically making short-term collateralized loans, which everybody needed and nobody could get. And suddenly our products became unbelievably profitable and everybody was making money doing exactly the same thing, which was just basically lending a ton of dollars across the world for, you know, really high price because everybody desperately needed them, and we were Citibank, a mass American bank, and we had them. And it's sort of the early period of the book is just me sort of, I get dropped on this desk in June 2008. The world blows up like 3 months later. There's a bunch of sort of nutters on the desk, you know. Some of them are still my friends today. And they start making tons of money. And I'm just sort of like scrabbling around trying to figure out how they're doing it. And I figure out eventually after a few months what they're doing is they're just lending tons and tons of US dollars out, you know, because everybody needs them at a really high interest rate.
And to be clear, when you say they're collateralized, you know, this is all kind of weirdly repo-ish. We don't need to get into the nuts and bolts of it. But because those loans are collateralized and because they're in US dollars, does that mean that from like a capital perspective, they're not that expensive to Citibank? The Citibank didn't need a lot of money. How much, when you put on a $1 billion trade from that desk, how much capital does the Citibank need to put up? How much of its own money is Citibank risking this?
Well, I'm not sure about the regulations, but I fund the loans myself, basically. So I suspect not very much. So at that time, unsecured lending, just outright loans, basically collapsed. But a foreign exchange swap is you give one currency as collateral. So what we would do as foreign exchange traders is I would lend dollars out for 1 year and I would have to sort of borrow Swiss francs against it. And I would borrow the dollars back every day. So actually, Citibank never needs to actually pay these loans out. I fund them myself. We're just lending. Look, all Citibank has to do is backstop them, basically agree like we will make sure that this loan gets paid. So, you know, I'm not involved in the sort of the side of how much money has to get put aside to protect these things, but we funded them all ourselves.
We'll be right back after this. You rapidly, when you started making a name for yourself, started getting calls from headhunters and recruiters. How much of that came from non-banks, from like the buy side, from hedge funds, from places like that?
So in 2011, which is when I was Citibank's big trader, I turned 25 that year. And that's sort of when I started getting loads and loads of calls. I got calls from Goldman. I got calls from Barclays. They come through headhunters. But I don't, now friends of mine have gone into the buy side. But the truth is, suddenly, STIRT traders, FX swap traders at big banks like Citibank were making so much money. They were making enormous amounts. When the numbers are in the book, but I was making millions of dollars in my early 20s. So I never really considered leaving for the buy side. Now I do trade my own money for myself. But in that period, it was so easy to make money as an FX swap trader for a big bank that I never considered leaving all.
And I guess my question, and we'll, you know, move on, but like, I guess my question is, what is it about working for a bank that makes it so easy to make money trading that instrument at a bank? Like, for instance, you were dealing mostly with corporates, right? Your end users were corporates. Like, we recently had Rob Copeland on this show, who wrote a big book about Bridgewater. And one of his things was like, no one, you know, they have $160 billion, but no one really sees them in the markets. It's all a bit mysterious how they make their money. But presumably you weren't dealing with Bridgewater. Did you see Bridgewater ever? Or is it all really just like banks and corporations and that whole sort of side edifice of like non-bank financial institutions was largely invisible?
I think in the immediate aftermath of 2008, especially the 1 or 2 years after 2008, what basically happened is the bid offer spread on FX swaps went totally insane. So with the view is...
And why? I guess my question is, why wasn't that arbed away by the Bridgewaters of the world?
Why didn't they come in? I guess they probably couldn't. I guess they couldn't access... I mean, probably they did try to do some. I suppose, you know, my first trade I did in 2009. It's a billion-dollar loan. I think that possibly these hedge funds can't do it or couldn't do it at the time. The volatility was super high. But I mean, could they have done it? I suspect they didn't have the balance sheet. It's quite a technical question for it. But these foreign exchange swaps, they go on the balance sheet.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I'm coming back to, which is the reason you're able to make so much money is because you had that enormous balance sheet. And that's the thing. That's precisely the thing that like Paul Volcker was worried about when he implemented the Volcker rule. That's precisely the thing that, you know, a couple years later blew up at JP Morgan. They had the London Whale and that kind of thing. And people are like, if you're going to take those kind of risks with balance sheet, then, you know, you shouldn't be in a closely regulated, too big to fail financial institution. Does that like ring true to you? Or is that just like, no, we weren't actually taking that much risk. Everything was collateralized. I was funding it myself.
No, there were big risks. You know, this is discussed a little bit in the book as well. You know, at that period in time, 2009, 2010, late 2008, everyone on the desk was doing the same trade essentially, which was lending dollars long-term through foreign exchange swaps at about 2-2.5% and borrowing them back in the day-to-day market at 0%, which was the base rate. And everybody on the desk had that same trade. And from a risk perspective, at the time, I didn't really realize it. There's a small like discussion about this in the book. I was like 21. I had no idea. I was just copying everyone else on the desk. But there was this sort of older trader called Bill in the book, who sort of took me under his wing. And we have a chat about it. And he says, listen, this trade will go under in one situation, which is that the US banking system and then the global banking system collapses. That is the situation in which this trade loses money. And if that happens, who the fuck cares? Because we were all losing our jobs, right? I always remember there was a big sort of meeting with all the traders. They called it an offsite. All the traders in the world came and met at some big, like, fancy country manor in 2011. And the big global head of trading stood up there. And they gave us all these hats, these camo hats with go big or go home written on the front. And he said, listen, if you're comfortable taking a risk in $1 million, take it in $10 million. You know, and then everybody went back to the trading floor and blew up immediately because they're not used to trading with this amount of money. But the thing is, who stops it? Because my boss gets paid on my P&L. His boss gets paid on my P&L. His boss gets paid on my P&L. The CEO gets paid on my P&L. So within the bank, it's not in anybody's interest to stop all the traders from making the same trade. The trade only loses money if the bank blows up, in which case we're losing our jobs anyway. So I guess, you know, there definitely is a structural problem here.
The other great genre of people that you talk about at some length in the book are the brokers. And the brokers don't take any risk at all, but they're this sort of incredibly important intermediary link. Tell me a little bit about them and what they do and why they're necessary.
So the brokers, I mean, this has probably changed since I left the trading floor, but at the time, the brokers were completely the social fabric of the trading floor. I think some people don't know the difference between brokers and traders. Brokers, when I were there, were basically professional party planners for traders. That was what you know, 95% of them were doing. So to be explicit about what they do, brokers are basically, they're like estate agents. You want to buy something, you tell your broker, and your broker will just shout it down these open lines. He has open lines to all of the traders in London or the big traders in New York. I want to buy something at 27. He'll start shouting 27 bid, 27 bid, 27 bid, and all the lines. And that's a way of me getting a deal done without anybody knowing beforehand that I'm the transactor. Because if they know I'm a buyer, maybe it'll push the market. So they're supposed to be there for basically transacting. But, you know, what's the difference between one broker and another? You know, all they do is go around and shout 27 bid, 27 bid, 27 bid. Well, the difference is really largely social. So as soon as you come in as a trader, these guys, they want to take you out. They want to take you to Nobu. They want to figure out what you like. Oh, you like football? I take you to the football. Does your dad like football? Maybe we can take your dad to the football. You know what I mean? Oh, you know, you like nightclubs? You want a table in a nightclub? We'll take you to a nightclub. And they're paying for everything, obviously. And they are just trying to basically build kind of parasitic social relationships. And I think really underneath this, there's kind of a level of almost pure corruption, which is that traders, when I was there, used to get paid about 7% of their P&L. And brokers used to get paid about 30% of their P&L. So I think in an extent, what's happening here is traders are paying some of their P&L to brokers. They would have got paid 7% of that. The brokers get paid 30% and they can give you 15% back in basically favors. Really? I mean, I think there's a degree to which what these guys are doing is basically pure corruption. But I mean, it goes deeper than that, really. I don't discuss this in the book, but, you know, even some of the corporate clients of big banks, you know, you transact as a trader, the spreads, they're tiny. And then every now and again, you'll get a client come in and trade on a much bigger spread, like massive spread, you know, and you make some money off it. And it's sort of like, you know, why is this guy trading on that terrible price? Well, that guy who's executing for some corporate or some hedge fund, he is probably not on performance-related pay. But the sales guy who talks with him is. So the sales guy is giving him a bad price and then he's taking him out, you know, he's taking his family to Wimbledon. You know, this kind of stuff goes, you know, throughout the whole thing. But ultimately what they end up providing is they provide the social backdrop for the whole city. You know, these are the guys in pubs, in bars, in nightclubs, in sometimes even less savory places, you know, sneaking traders, strippers and cocaine a lot of the time. That's what was happening when I was there.
Is it a sustainable job? Did you know anyone who'd managed to be a broker for more than a few years?
Well, of course, there's a character in the book, isn't there? Harry Sambi in the book, who is a friend of mine who I grew up with, a few years younger than me, grew up on my street. My mum is a child of mine. And, you know, for certain reasons, which you'll see in the book, you know, he kind of gets left at a loose end. And through me, ends up coming into the city and being a broker. And you kind of see what happens to like a young, impressionable kid when they get dropped in that world. You know, it's a lot of partying. There's a lot of drinking. There can be a lot of drug usage, and it took its toll on him, and it took its toll on a lot of people. But, you know, a lot of these guys have got 3 or 4 divorces to pay for, so they do have to stick around.
I mean, that happens to your boss in the book, right? Is that he achieves the dream, like retires at age 29 or something, fucks off to California, and then comes back.
Yeah, I mean, this guy didn't have divorces to pay for, you know, so this is one of the big questions. In my sense, one of the big questions of the book, right? So I got hired by this like young superstar manager in the book. He's called Caleb. As you say, right, 29, I'd only been there for about a year. He's like, that's it, I'm quitting. I made enough money, going to build my dream house in Northern California. And I was kind of like, oh, that's fantastic. It's amazing. Like, you can really live the dream. You can get in, you can make your money, you can get out, you can have a nice life. And then suddenly, like a couple of years later, he comes back. And by then, I'm absolutely like sick of the world of trading. I hate it. I'm the top trader in the world and I absolutely hate it. And I'm sort of, this guy comes back and I just think, why the fuck are you back? And there's this conversation I had with him, which is we're out for a meal. And I really want to understand, why the fuck have you come back this like horrible place when you've got enough money? You know, I can't just say to him, you know, why are you back? Because it's disrespectful. So I say to him, you know, how is California? And he says to me, oh, he's wonderful, we had this beautiful house, you know, we built it ourselves and we had this huge garden with these huge trees and the kids were playing in the garden. But, you know, and I'm like, okay, you know, but what? And he's like, well, you know, there was a problem with the house. And I'm like, okay, what's the problem? He said, well, the thermostat was in the wrong place. It went, you know, it was too close to the fireplace. When the fire was on, the thermostat would trip and the heating would turn off. It would get too cold upstairs. And I just had this vision of this guy, like, who was, you know, he was youngest ever MD at Citibank, just sitting in this beautiful house in a massive chair with his beautiful wife, beautiful kids, just staring at the thermostat, you know, fingers twitching and just thinking, I need to be back on the trading floor. And in a way, for me, this book is about, it's about the obsession of wealthy and powerful men and why they're so obsessed with becoming wealthy and becoming more powerful and why they can't just, you know, these guys are worth 10, 20 million quid and they work 100-hour weeks and never see their kids. Why? Why do these guys do this? Why do they not walk away? Why do they stay on these trading floors, which are pretty obviously horrible places, when they're already worth 20 million quid? Why? And that is, in a sense, the big question of the book, I think.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a second. So the book ends basically with you doing just that, with walking away. And since then, have you had any kind of a proper job?
Have I had a proper job? So, you know, I became quite worried. You know, I made a ton of money by betting the global economy would be shit forever, basically, which is quite an interesting experience to have as an individual. And, you know, as you'll know, because you read the book, leaving was not made easy by the bank. I had some difficult experiences. I did take a little bit of downtime when I left. But since then, I've been doing various things, trying to basically explain to people that if we don't do anything about exploding global inequality, in particular inequality of wealth, living standards will collapse. At the beginning of COVID, it was really obvious to me that governments were going to give a shit ton of money out. The US government's given $10 trillion out since the beginning of COVID. That's total US government deficit. That's $80,000 per US tax base, an unbelievable amount of money. Straight away, at the beginning of COVID, who's going to end up with that money? who's going to end up with that money? You follow the money through the system. This money is basically a subsidy for the banned spending of the rich. So it goes to workers who can't work. They pay their rent. It goes to the rich who can't spend it. That money ends up accumulating in the bank accounts of the rich. So I knew from the beginning of COVID, oh my God, this is going to be the biggest economic disaster you have ever seen, because COVID was and remains the largest and fastest ever increase in inequality in the history of the Western world. And it's been immediately followed by the biggest collapse in living standards. So that's when I decided, you know, I have to sort of go public and start telling people, look, if you don't deal with this growing inequality, living standards will collapse. So I've got a YouTube channel, which is out there, Gary's Economics, where I explain these things to ordinary people, saying if you don't deal with it, living standards will collapse. I've obviously written this book, which is probably the closest thing I've had to a proper job. I went back to Oxford and did a 2-year master's trying to explain to professors that inequality matters. They generally didn't give a shit. But have I had a proper job? No, actually. I mean, I've done lots of things. I didn't trade for a few years, but I did have to start doing a little bit when COVID happened because it was just such easy money.
Did you get into the meme stocks and the crypto?
No, I didn't. What I did was, so, you know, as I've discussed in the book, you know, the big trade that I started doing in my career was betting that rates will never go up, which is basically you lend money out. Every now and again, people say rates will go up and you can lend money at 3%. And then I was lending money at 3%, rate stayed zero, and I borrowed back at zero. That's the trade I was doing before COVID. People probably don't remember. Before COVID, rates went up quite high in the US. You could get like 3-4% on a government bond, and they started collapsing. So I was sitting on these bonds. Yields collapsed in COVID. The bonds went through the roof. But I immediately knew the government is going to give out so much money that we are going to see the mother of all fucking asset inflations. And I need to get out of bonds, which are now yielding zero. I need to get me some assets. But gold, which is what I wanted, jumped up about 6-7% because other people, well, probably because interest rates collapsed. And I was thinking, fuck, I've missed the boat on gold. I'm sitting on these bonds. They're shit. And then when COVID went into like extreme panic phase, this mad thing happened, which is bond prices fell. And the gold price collapsed like 10% because people were like, all we want is cash. So here you've got a situation where the government is about to give $10 trillion cash out and all anybody wants is cash. So I just, you know, opened myself a betting account and just bet, you know, effectively bought $1 million worth of gold. Like right at the beginning of COVID at about 1480. That's what it was. It's over 2000 now. It was the easiest money I've ever made, because if you know the government's going to run a $10 trillion deficit, you want to buy fucking hard assets. It was unbelievable. You know, I think we haven't even seen nearly the end of it. You are going to see that the increase in house prices and the gold price and eventually stocks will be wobbly. It's going to be enormous because nobody's accounted for the fact that I think people don't really even understand that when the US government gives out $10 trillion, somebody gets $10 trillion. That's 80 grand per US taxpayer. So price levels have to be way higher.
I do need to ask you about the inequality thing, though, because yeah, like in the spring of 2020, you saw a bunch of people getting laid off and a bunch of, you know, increasing inequality. But since then, for the past 4 years or so, or certainly 3 years, we've seen the largest decrease in inequality like in modern history. A lot of the stimulus was aimed very much at the working poor, like the effective minimum wage in the United States effectively doubled from $7 to $15. If you look at the percentage gain in wealth or in income, the people in the lowest two quintiles have done even better than the people in the top, much better than people in the top quintile, better than the people in the top 5%, maybe not as well as the people in the top 1%. But in general, inequality, both domestically in the United States, I don't know about the UK, but in the United States and globally, has been coming down quite fast.
So I suspect you're talking about inequality of income. To be honest,
and wealth.
Wealth. I mean, the average US billionaire doubled their wealth in the first 1 year of COVID. It's in awe. The increase in the wealth of the 1%. To be honest, I don't really think anything that is happening outside the 1% really matters at the moment. The big shift we are seeing is everything accumulating to the 1%. That is what you're seeing. This is the big driving force of the economy is this, you know, $10 trillion, $10 trillion. Okay. That's $80,000 per US taxpayer. So we know that the average US taxpayer has accumulated an additional $80,000 cash. That's just accounting, okay? If the US government gives out $10 trillion, somebody gets $10 trillion. So How many of the listeners out there do you think are sitting on 80 grand cash more? Who has that $10 trillion
now? Well, I mean, I'm just going to say that my Slate Money listeners are incredibly wealthy and sophisticated. So that we've all made 80 grand in cash, probably more.
Well, I mean, that's good for them. But, you know, I think the vast majority of that has gone to richer people. You know, I'm sitting here in the UK, right? In the last 3 years, we've seen a massive increase in basically extreme poverty. People who can't afford to heat their homes, feed their kids. You know, that used to be 20% of the country that would struggle to heat and feed their families. That's 50% now. And that's going to increase because when that money goes to the rich, how do the rich disperse that money? You know, how do the rich get rid of this $10 trillion? In the UK, it's £800 billion. How do the rich get rid of it? How can the rich get rid of their money? You know, the only realistic way is buying assets from the middle class. So I think what you will see, and this is how you're going to see this massive increase in asset prices, the rich will use that money to buy the assets from the middle class and it will hollow out the middle class. The big thing is, the most amazing thing is, the complete lack of accounting by anyone if who has that money now. You know, if you give out $10 trillion, the scale of numbers matters. The scale of numbers matters. $10 trillion is unbelievably enormous. Economically, nothing has happened in the last 5 years except for the increase in the US government debt by $10 trillion. It is the only thing that matters because it is so much bigger than anything else. You need to know where that money is. And I think that the most amazing thing I've ever witnessed, definitely as an economist in my life, is the fact that nobody, you know, if the US government's going to give out $10 trillion, the newspapers, the Democrats, the economists, they should all be saying, who's going to accumulate $10 trillion? Nobody even did that analysis, except for me, and I made a ton of money on it.
We are now, I believe, at a $35 trillion national debt, $34 trillion, something like that. One of the standard things that happens in US politics is that the likes of Bob Rubin love to bellyache about the national debt and how it's a big problem. You're a rates trader. One of the things that people say about high national debts is, oh, this is going to force the government to pay lots of money on its debt. The interest payments are going to go up as a percentage of tax revenues and all of this kind of stuff. Just in terms of government finance, in terms of like fiscal policy, is this something that anyone should be worried about?
Possibly. I think the most likely outcome here, and we're starting to see it creep in, is that inflation keeps coming down. It's already come down a long way. Interest rates are expected to start coming down. Base rates are expected to start coming down. Government bond rate yields are already started falling. I suspect that will continue. And if that does continue, then in a sense, government financing is not the biggest problem, because if you look at the real yield on this debt, it's not particularly high. It's quite possible it will go back down relatively quickly to zero. The big risk, you know, as a trader, what you want to know is, what is the big problem that nobody knows? Because that's how you make the money. The big problem is the other side of the debt. The big problem is the other side of the debt. If the US government debt goes up $10 trillion, somebody has $10 trillion. So somebody's getting massively, massively richer. On the other side of the government debt is a massive change in the wealth distribution. You know, if that $10 trillion was equally spread throughout society, $80,000 per taxpayer, would it really matter that much? You know, if wealth transfers from the government to the people, it shouldn't really make much difference. The government is supposed to represent the people. But what if that $10 trillion went overwhelmingly to the top 1% or 2%? What then? Well, then you've massively changed your wealth distribution in society. Well, if you massively change your wealth distribution, you need to change your consumption distribution. You know, the consumption distribution has to reflect that. You need to change your real asset holding distribution. The rich are much, 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 much richer now. They have to consume more stuff. And the middle class has to consume less stuff. The middle class has to have less food, has to have less energy, has to have less housing, because we've changed the distribution.
I think this is an English way of looking at things. I think in the US, the middle class is doing really well. And in fact, compared to pre-pandemic, the poor are doing really well. And maybe they didn't get most of the $10 trillion, but they got enough of it to increase their wealth to levels that were unprecedented.
Do you mean the 50th percentile there when you say middle class?
So, yes. I mean, basically 50th percentile and down.
I'd love to get some of them on and ask them what they think about that, the fact that they're doing really well. Because I don't think they're doing really well. They've seen a massive increase in inflation.
It's true that the vibes are off, but the real wages, especially at the, you know, 20th percentile, 40th percentile, are up hugely.
You know, you and I both have not spent much time in the 50th percentile, but the people I grew up with have. And, you know, I'm here in the UK, so, you know, maybe you're right and maybe life is getting way better in the US. But, you know, we've seen a massive increase in food price, energy price, rent price. If you get these guys in and ask them, do you think your life economically has gotten better over the last 5 years? People at the 50th percentile of wealth and income, I don't think many of them will be saying yes. And, you know, maybe you're right and life has gotten better in the US. I'm not in the US. You know, you are. You know, people can comment and say what they think if they're around about that level.
But yeah, as members of the rich, we just get to, for the time being, enjoy 5% interest on our savings accounts and just spend lots of money. It's nice for us. Gary Stevenson, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been absolutely brilliant talking to you.
That's okay. Thanks for having me.
And your book is out in all good bookstores now. It's called The Trading Game, A Confession. Thanks for listening to Slate Money. Thank you to Jared Downing and Shayna Roth for producing. And we'll be back on Saturday with a regular Slate Money.